From the Credit Union National Association, this is the CUNA News Podcast. Credit Union People, Credit Union Ideas.
Welcome to the CUNA News Podcast. I'm Bill Merrick, Deputy Editor at CUNA. This week's episode looks at pending interchange legislation and its potential impact on credit unions, consumers, and small businesses. The Credit Card Competition Act of 2023, known as Durbin 2.0, would not only reduce credit unions' interchange income, it would threaten consumer data security, privacy, and access to credit. Most importantly, the bill could harm credit unions' community service efforts. We begin with Jason Sturrock, CUNA's Deputy Chief Advocacy Officer. He explains the implications of Durbin 2.0, how the CUNA League advocacy team is addressing this threat, and how credit union leaders can get involved. We continue with a look at how KCT Credit Union in Elgin, Illinois, uses its interchange income earned from its affinity, purchase, and other card transactions to assist local school districts. Mike Lee, KCT President and CEO, Richard Gose, CUNA's Chief Political Officer, and Keith Sias, Senior Vice President of Governmental Affairs at the Illinois Credit Union League, weigh in. We have a lot of ground to cover, so let's get started. Here's Jason Sturrock. Welcome to the CUNA News Podcast, Jason Sturrock. Good to see you again.
Good to see you again, Bill.
Early this year, the CUNA League advocacy team kind of teamed up to beat back the Credit Card Competition Act from moving forward in the previous Congress.
Yep.
So what happened? Why are we reliving this now?
Well, I mean, honestly, because the retailers and Senator Durbin are not going to let this go. This is going to be a fight as long as Congress exists, you know, you like to say. You know, both in the last Congress, you know, Senator Durbin was able to get Senator Marshall from Kansas to join him in introducing that legislation. And because, as you referenced, that incredibly strong partnership between CUNA and our partners in the leagues all across the country, we were able to stop it in its tracks, essentially. But this Congress, they introduced the legislation again. Then was now Senator Welch from Vermont. He was the House sponsor last year, moved into the Senate, so he's joined it. It has been a constant issue that we have been discussing and at the top of the advocacy agenda for CUNA in our leagues, going all the way back to GAC, educating new members of Congress, their staff, on the negative impacts that the CCCA would have on all credit unions and financial institutions across the country. Obviously, the fight on this bill is a little different this year around because there are more vehicles that they're trying to attach the legislation to. We're going into the reauthorization of the Farm Bill. That is must-pass legislation in the Congress that we have now that rarely passes massive legislation. They try to find a bill that is going through, whether it be the appropriations bills or the NDAA, and try to put it in there. So we make the joke that now the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, now is a banking section. They're continually trying to put that in there. And as you saw in the news, you know, at the end of July, as the Senate was debating the NDAA, Senator Marshall was attempting to include a vote on the amendment. Thankfully, led by CUNA and our league partners, we were able to stop that. But that does not mean that once we come back in September, that this fight is over. It will continue. They'll look for other pieces of legislation to attach it to. And CUNA and our partners and the entire financial services industry will be standing up on behalf of all these community institutions.
Sure, sure. So we kind of dodged a bullet there then.
Well, we dodged one. And if anyone can remember back to the Matrix, there's a lot of bullets that we're going to be dodging on this one. But that's why we have an incredibly strong advocacy, not only at CUNA in Washington, D.C., but our partners at all the leagues and their advocacy staffs that they have. But most importantly, the incredible amount of individual credit union members, CEOs, credit union staffers all across this country that got involved in this effort. And I'm proud to report through our incredible political team and our partners, the investments that we've made just on the campaign to oppose the inclusion of the CCCA and the NDAA in the summer. We've made close to 80,000 contacts onto Capitol Hill, and that is significantly larger than any other trade association on this issue.
Wow, that's huge. That's a lot.
it is well and above exponentially larger than what others have done. And that kind of shows the strength of credit unions in our over 137 million members all across this country. We are cooperative. We are collaborative. When there is a threat to, you know, credit unions and our ability to serve our communities, we come together and we stand shoulder to shoulder to make sure that not only members of Congress, but state capitals, agencies here, what is good for credit unions is going to be good for their communities.
So I guess backing up a little bit, can you tell us what's in this bill and what it would do?
Yeah, I mean, I'll give you kind of that 100,000 foot level. What the Marshall-Durbin interchange bill would do is require that for all credit cards that are issued, that there would be two routing networks on the back of your card. And they cannot both be Visa or MasterCard. So you have to have MasterCard and then a company that doesn't exist at this point, or a new entrance into the market, or a Visa and somebody else. So what you are then forcing upon those institutions is kind of a race to the bottom, as we like to call it. A lot of what the interchange fee pays for is your privacy and your data security. What this bill does is put that at threat. So while there is a claim that there is an exemption for institutions of $100 billion and below, anyone who's been around since Durbin 1 on debit cards, which had that same level of an exemption for institutions of $10 billion and below, you know, you ask those community institutions like credit unions, they lost over 30% of their income. Their rewards programs went away. They had to raise fees in other institutions. The ability for them to serve the underserved communities or those at the marginal levels that credit unions try to reach out to, that was curtailed. And we know that that will empirically happen with changes to the credit card interchange moving forward if Durbin and Marshall is passed.
And what's the argument for passage of this bill?
Well, I'll put that other hat on if you'd like me to. Not an argument I've made lately of why you should support the bill, but you know, hearing from the retailers and others and from still from friends up on Capitol Hill, they'll make the argument that in light of massive amount of inflation that's going on or perceived in the country, that the fees that are charged, you know, would be a way to lower costs. They also believe that this would increase competition on the payment side to drive down the costs. And they believe that both Visa and MasterCard have a monopoly, and that is unfair. So, I mean, that's kind of the main argument is that the fees are too high. This is a way to get them down, and government needs to intervene rather than the market.
And what would be the, potential consequences for consumers and small businesses if this does become law?
As I referenced earlier, just go back to look what happened with debit. For consumers, you know, for credit unions specifically, where the message that we have been talking about and the evidence that backs it up is that the reduction in the revenue that small institutions like credit unions get from credit cards, the loss of that ensures that there's less money to keep the doors open or run free checking programs or, you know, take, you know, the access to credit to those individuals that maybe sit with a marginal credit score. Credit unions exist to take the chance on the people that the banks have left behind. And this loss of non-interest-bearing revenue, non-interest-bearing income, directly threatens credit unions' ability to serve their communities. Now, we saw that in debit card. When you talk about the 30% reduction in revenue just by the loss of the debit, that will be there in spades for credit card interchange income for those institutions. What it'll also then force is, you know, Chase, Bank of America, other large financial institutions, they'll be able to absorb what your smaller institutions like credit unions, your small community institutions, they're not going to be able to offer credit cards anymore. So then we have one less product that an institution, a community institution can offer to its customers or its members. And that is fundamentally unfair. You know, everyone likes to think that, you know, the credit card is, you know, I'm running around buying my next trip to, you know, Honolulu on my first class Delta flight and all that type of stuff. For the majority of credit union members, their access to credit and their credit card is in lieu of a payday loan. Like, hey, an unexpected expense, I need $400 for an engine repair or groceries or school supplies, you know, that temporary bridge. And by taking away that ability to offer credit to those marginal communities and the people on the margins, We're then driving them over to a payday loan center where they're going to pay interest that you've never seen before, or you know, that that's double, triple, quadruple, you know, what their interest would be on their credit card. That's an incredibly poor option.
Fraud protections are a big part of this issue too. Can you walk us through that?
Absolutely. You know, it's the interchange fee that is charged when you swipe your credit card. It's the price of doing business. It's the cost of that transaction. And what that does is allow the institutions like Visa and MasterCard and others to set up a secure system to be able to ensure that, you know, it's processed, you know, the merchant is paid right away, and your data is protected. When you force that second network that not likely going to have the same security in place with Visa and MasterCard in the established, you know, payment systems, you're having a race to the bottom, and what's going to get sacrificed first is data security, of which people are becoming more and more demanding. You know, when we look at what people ask for when they look at credit cards, interchange fee is not even close in terms of one of the concerns. They want to make sure it's accepted. They want to make sure that their data is secure and that their transactions will go through. Those are the three highest priorities for anybody who uses a credit card in this country.
And CUNA recently released a study that kind of outlines the continued negative impact of interchange legislation on consumers and small businesses and financial institutions. What stands out to you from this report?
There's a few issues I'd like to highlight, and that, you know, kind of what our report talked about was that, you know, merchants in any network that processes card transactions must be held accountable to the same standard for fraud protection. You know, credit unions are held to an incredibly high standard in terms of protecting people's security, and they'd like that all across the system, both on the retailers, but also on the payment security side, you know, and that regulation should not be enacted because they harm both consumers and the banking system. I mean, when there's other networks that is going to get added, we are going to naturally see a loss of security and data privacy. And how many times have we worried about people stealing our identity or our transactions and going onto the dark web? You know, we have a system that has worked, that is the envy of the world, that you can go into any institution if you have a card, if you have a credit card, you know, and as long as you have available credit, I'm taking that off the table, it's going to be accepted. The merchant is going to get paid right away, and that ease of use. And that's what people are really looking for. That small percentage that you pay on that swipe ensures that your data is secure, your purchase is going to be accepted, and that you can use it wherever credit cards are accepted.
And you've talked about how, like, the CUNA League system is tackling this issue. How can credit union leaders respond and get involved?
It's kind of the sweet spot, you know, for credit unions is that our commitment to the community gives us a leg up on others. We know who our members of Congress are, their staffs are, who the influencers are, and it's time to put some of that shoe leather, you know, member advocacy into practice. Reaching out to your member of Congress. If you are a CEO or a president of a credit union, invite your member of Congress to come to your credit union, meet with your board, meet with people. I'd like to say that, you know what? Ask your member of Congress or your, you know, senator to come be a teller for the day. See what their employees go through. See what a loan processor goes through. See everything you have to deal with. It's a great way to educate them and their staff about what you as an institution are doing to serve the communities that they represent. And then building up that level of trust and talking about interchange and talking about access to credit and talking about field of membership and member business lending caps. And, you know, if those were changed, how you could dramatically reach out to more veterans and more people in your community and help them grow small businesses is incredibly important. Credit unions and every member of a credit union, you are a member of the CUNA League advocacy team. Because as a cooperative being member-owned, we all speak with the same voice in terms of it isn't just us as the lobbyists in Washington, D.C., or the lobbyists at the league at the state capitals. My former boss, he'd go through the grocery store and, you know, the teller would talk to him about an issue or bump into him at a Menards. Or he'd always tell us those stories. And those are incredibly impactful because it's not someone who's paid. It's someone who cares. That is stepping up and saying, these are important issues. And we have resources available, not only for the leagues, but up on the CUNA.org website, on our advocacy side, about interchange to help educate, and multitude of other issues as well. The most important step that anyone can do is to raise their hand and say, how can I help?
And that's, a very compelling argument that credit unions have. It just makes me wonder, why is this such a big priority for Senator Durbin, do you think?
I will not delve into his reasons why, but, any member, they get an issue that they are passionate about, and we will continue to educate Senator Durbin, Senator Marshall, and every member of Congress in both the House and the Senate on why pursuing this type of legislation is wrong. It will not achieve the intended benefits that they promise and will actually do more harm than good, to the communities that they represent.
So what's next? You mentioned, the next session of Congress coming up in the fall. What's the timeline or likely timeline for a vote on this legislation?
There are must-pass pieces of legislation when we come back in September. The federal government's fiscal year ends on September 30th, so either they're going to pass the spending bills or we're going to have a continuing resolution, make sure that it's not added to that. So they now have to have the House pass. You have the House and the Senate's versions of the NDAA. They'll go to conference committee, make sure it's not included in there. You have the farm bill coming up. I'm talking about bills that have to pass that they'll try to attach everything to, or as we used to call it up on the Hill, start Christmas treeing it and adding everything every ornament they can to it. You have the FAA authorization. You have, the extension of the National Flood Insurance Program. Then you have the year-end spending bill. Then you have the tax packages. It's going to be a daily, weekly, monthly grind to make sure that this legislation, which I do want to point out, has not had a hearing in either the House Financial Services or the Senate Banking Committee, and they want to take it directly to the floor without any debate and try to add it to a bill. But we're just going to make sure we're working with our league partners and our allies to make sure that that does not happen, that we're continually educating. I know that we are blessed to have a multitude of leagues and having fly-ins in September, October, and November, bringing hundreds upon hundreds of credit union leaders from all across the country up to Washington, D.C., to Capitol Hill to meet with their members of Congress. This will obviously be one of the number one or two issues that they will bring up with their members all the way through this year and all the way through next year and after the election when we go into a lame duck session, which can be even frightening because then you have a lot of members of Congress who either were invited by their constituents to come back home permanently or decided not to run or lost. And they're like, they may make the decision that they don't care how they vote anymore. There's a lot of milestones along the way, but I'm very confident that with the millions of credit union members, their individual institutions, the leagues and CUNA helping lead this effort, that we will be successful in continually educating members and their staff that the Durbin-Marshall Bill is not a good policy to be enacted.
Well, it certainly shows the need for continuous advocacy. And
you do. And that's why we are blessed to have, more credit unions and more communities that touch more members of Congress. We've had to become experts in working with the Armed Services Committee, the Agriculture Committees, where we used to just have to deal with House Financial Services and Senate Banking. Coming from, farm country myself of North and South Dakota, I'm helping to educate people on, okay, this is how you talk about farm issues. And, this is ag and why it's important. So, and be able to tap into that. I've always said that credit unions' diversity is our greatest strength, and I'm talking diversity of backgrounds and locations and experience and education is our secret sauce, our secret weapon to helping ensure that we are as prepared as we can be in these fights. And the moment we think we haven't won is when we will lose, or the moment that we kind of lay back and think that they're not going to get it done is the moment they do get it in, because that's what happened in Durbin 1. I tell the team and I tell everyone I talk to, we're going to run through the tape. We're going to go all the way through. We're going to keep fighting until the clock hits zero. Because this is so vitally important to the future success of our credit unions being able to serve their communities.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
A lot of it is a grateful thank you. There's a reason we got close to 80,000 messages into Capitol Hill, and that's because of a great advocacy team at CUNA. As importantly, incredible advocacy partners at all the leagues across this country and advocacy leaders at credit union institutions of all sizes, from Alaska to Florida and Maine to Hawaii and every place in between, who understand the need to participate and to raise their hand and say, what more can I do? If you've not been told thank you, let me please do it on behalf of everyone at CUNA and throughout the credit union movement, because if not for those 80,000 contacts and the starting at GAC and the multitude of phone calls. And I know there were multiple leagues that helped do emergency fly-ins to talk to their members or back home in their districts on the Martian-Durbin Amendment trying to get into the NDA. I don't know if we would have been successful, but CUNA and our league partners and the credit unions across this country and credit union members stood up and said, this is bad policy and we're going to make sure our voices are heard.
We now talk to Mike Lee, Keith Sias, and Richard Gose about how credit unions use interchange revenues to assist their communities. So Mike, you had mentioned that not only is interchange revenue a form of non-interest income, it's a means for credit unions to give back to their members and their communities. Can you talk about the role of cards in supporting your members and the communities you serve?
Yeah, Bill. One of the challenges at credit unions is we live on a very small ROA. So when you look at my balance sheet, a typical credit union lives off of less than 1% ROA. So sometimes because of that, we have to get very creative in how we can give back to the community. So early on in my tenure here, we saw cards as a way to support our community through a couple different tools. Originally started with an affinity card. What an affinity card is we go into a school district and we white label our cards with their logo. Typically, we will actually issue a few cards. One will be maybe a general administrative card for the whole district. And then in addition to that, a lot of the school districts like to promote their high school mascot logo. So if they have two or three high schools, we have two or three cards. And we also do this for both debit and credit. Part of the reason we do that, as a credit union that lives and eats financial empowerment and wellness, we don't really believe in credit card debt. So we really try not to build that. And the reason I'm sharing that, that's an important piece, because when I issue cards, the only income I can really derive off of a lot of our cards is from interchange. So what we do with these cards is then we share our interchange income with that school district. On debit cards, we give them 20% of our interchange, and on credit, we give them 25%. Typically, how that works in a school district, and I like this because I know exactly where the funds are going, we work with their local educational foundation. So every school district pretty much across the nation has a foundation. What that foundation does is they support the things that the school district can't support, like specific scholarships for students. Probably the biggest one is supplies that teachers need in the classroom. A lot of people don't know that when teachers start the school year, sometimes they'll spend $400 or $500 just to get their classroom ready. And they have no way of being reimbursed for that. So what we've done with these cards working through the foundation is we've supplied the funds to enable these school districts to really prosper with helping their teachers in a way that's not taken out of the taxpayer's pocket. It's us doing it as a not-for-profit cooperative financial institution supporting our local school districts. But I can go on. I don't want to keep going, but we have a lot of different ways. Affinity cards kind of started it, and now we're in about, I think we have 14 different affinity cards out with different organizations. And then about a couple of years ago, some school districts came to us and asked us to do what's called a purchase card, a PU card. Now, the P card's a very interesting different tool. It smells and looks like a corporate credit card, but the difference is there is no credit available. So at month end, every month, that entity, that school district, has to pay that card off totally. And the reason I share that, I never can get any type of interest income off of that card because there is no interest that can be applied to the card. So kind of think of it, it's an incredible loyalty card that you might have in your wallet, but we're offering that to the organization. Now, interchange with commercial is a little different formula than retail. Retail runs about 1 to 1.25. Commercial runs about 2.2 to 2.3. But because of our support in the community, we have created a program that we give them 1.5% back. So when you look at my value proposition or my ROA on this, I'm only making 80 basis points. And that's the only opportunity for income I have. But even more important, that doesn't even collect all my cost of issuing the cards, the technology, because we also offer a robust administrative tool on the back end so the school district can manage their cards And on the front end, we actually have an app that the user, so it's like you have an expense account, you actually have an app that helps you organize that, take pictures of receipts. So we have created this incredible tool for the school district to manage their cards and at the same time get a 1.5% back.
Mike made an important point I don't want to lose there. He talked about the interest. Right now, credit unions only make about $90 a card on average, they report to us. That's down from $110 they made just a couple of years ago. But the money they're making on those cards is coming from the carried interest. And, you know, if you think about our financial well-being mantra, that's really kind of contrary to what we would like to see overall. And right now, every time a credit union processes a card, they're losing money. And so the cost of cards are about 1.6 times more than revenue off interchange. And that is causing a lot of folks like Mike not to be able to do some of these programs that are so helpful for our communities. And that's a key reason that we're fighting as hard as we are on this issue.
And another thing, Bill, which I probably should have mentioned, the local banks won't do this. And I don't know if we want to use the B word, but the problem is what I'm doing with these school districts, there's not enough volume for their interest. So I'm actually offering and customizing things that banks would never even consider. And we have had a couple times where the school districts have said, you know, because everything we do is under a microscope, we have to bid this out. Well, typically, we don't even get anybody to bid against us because there's just not enough volume. So it's really interesting.
But taxpayers win, Mike, when you do that. It helps the school districts and the taxpayers win.
How much money do you raise through these efforts for the school districts?
Well, last year, and what is amazing about this, and I'll back up a little bit, these foundations love these cards because it's reoccurring income. So another way to say that candy bar they sold last year, they don't have to sell it again this year. And anybody who's affiliated with a foundation knows that if you're on a foundation board, your middle name is fundraiser, right? That's what you do. So these card programs, they literally grow every year. And it's kind of amazing. We've not had one go backwards. Last year at KCT, between all of our give back, before our cards and all, we gave about $240,000 back to our community just through cards. And the purchase card, we do have a number of new entities right now bringing those programs up. They're monstrous. Our first school district alone, their P card give back was $90,000 last year. So it's significant. It's significant.
And Bill, you know, you'll hear Senator Durbin talk about, well, you're under $100 billion in assets, so it won't affect you. Well, but it will, because the way interchange works is the overall process is, you have the merchant bank that's going to take in their portion, Visa, MasterCard, the processing portion, and then the issuers gets the largest portion, and that's why you're able to do some of these things. But when the pressures, regardless of which end it comes from, and we saw this on debit with the $10 billion cap, when the pressures come in, those margins are going to shrink. And it doesn't matter if you're under the $100 billion or if you're over, you're obviously going to get hit. So programs that Michael and other credit unions like Mike's are running are going to not be able to afford, in some cases, or take and remove revenue streams from other areas to keep funding these kind of programs. It's going to put more pressure on credit unions to do this.
And Bill, there's a couple other areas that I'll touch on that probably won't be touched on by others. So we also do health savings accounts, and we also do secured credit cards. And the reason I want to talk about those is typically when they're offered by other entities, there's fees associated with them. We have no fees with either of those cards. Now, let me explain. One of the school districts a couple years ago came and said, hey, Mike, we're going to high deductible health plan. Could you offer the health savings account? And we built a card. We logoed it with the school district. But the way our program works, if you're using this program right, first of all, it is basically a debit card. Okay, it's not even a credit card. So once again, other than maybe the funds that we get to use, there is no additional income flow. So what we're doing is providing a card to the school district to support their health insurance program. that has no fees or anything associated with it. It's another use that interchange is the only thing that makes that work for me. The next card is a secured credit card, and this is a big one. So we just went to a relationship with actually a radio host here in the Chicagoland area that is helping people prepare themselves for home ownership. So how you use a secured credit card, it's used as a credit builder. So let's say you don't qualify for a card on your own credit merit. If you put $500, $1,000 at KCT, we will issue you a card. Now, the issue with these cards that is kind of counterintuitive, we don't want those people to ever pay interest on those cards because it depletes their credit. So what they do with these cards, and this is a magic number, with a credit card, if you really want it to work right and help build your credit, you only use about 30% of the available funds. So if you had a $1,000 credit limit, you only use $300 a month. So when we offer these cards, we are actually telling people, don't use these cards like you would other cards at the demise of the credit union, because if they use them more, we would make more money. But it goes back to our commitment to financial empowerment and wellness. So think about that, what we're trying to do and across the nation. And one of the things I'm very involved in the state with financial wellness, as you also know, it is a big mandate with the federal government right now. So what we're doing, the tools we've established and have built at credit unions to help people, it's very connected to interchange, our ability to offer these cards. Now, what is interesting about secured credit cards, if you see them online or a lot of other entities, they have a fee up front. It can be as high as a couple hundred dollars to get a secured card, and then they have annual fees. We have none of that, but it's the right thing to do. We're credit unions. We're not-for-profits. But my point is, there's a lot of other pieces of cards that maybe aren't thought about every day. You think about the credit and the debit, but you don't think about health savings accounts. You don't think about secured credit cards, use this credit card as builders for your credit. So this really touches a lot of other areas that we're doing good work to help people live better financially.
And Bill, 79% of credit unions offer secured credit cards, and it's a key part of what they do in order to help their members.
So the interchange income allows you to not charge fees on any of your cards, which is great for the consumers. So the consumers could really suffer if Durbin 2.0 goes into effect.
We know with Durbin 1.0, less than 1% of the dollars went back to the consumers. That's GAO has confirmed, it's been fed. We just did the Cornerstone study reaffirming that as well. And they asked prospectively a lot of businesses what they would do. And we're not going to see the return on the merchant side. So if you squeeze credit unions, you're not getting the return on the merchant side. Then what you're doing is you're putting a vice on the consumer, and they're ultimately going to pay the cost through either lost opportunities or direct, more expensive acquisition or whatever they buy or the interchange system as a whole.
And that's something we should talk about before we talk about all this, is just the foundational way that credit unions use cards. So right now, I have no fees, annual fees on any of my cards, and I still have fixed rate cards. Now, what a fixed rate card is, it's a card that is locked in the rate. So my best card is 7.99, and it can't go up. So my point is, I can kind of make that work. That's the challenge in this rate environment. But without interchange income, it makes that challenge even harder. So this 7.99 card, it is an incredible card for a consumer to get. I mean, it's almost cheaper than what you can get a mortgage for today. And will I be able to offer that in the future if these things happen? And the answer is, it goes back to where I originally started. Credit unions don't have the fat to absorb this. We give back to our communities. We live off of very small margins. And every little thing like this has a big effect. It's a trickle-down effect to our whole strategic way that we serve our community by having little or no fees, paying great rates, having, you know, loans that I would call them are at the consumer's best interest. So it's complicated of how all these pieces contribute to our overall, you know, financial statement.
I would think that message would resonate pretty well with legislators. Have they been receptive to when you explain all of this to them?
You know, Bill, I think, and I'm very blessed, we put a lot of time into our local politicians. I think the challenge that we see a lot of times, and I know Kuna, Keith, all of us on the talk here, at a glance, you look at something and you think it's good because it's pro-consumer, whatever. But what has been the blessing in my career is I can get with these politicians and say, yeah, A looks good, but let's look at B, C, D, F. And that is our job, is to educate them and have partnerships with them to make sure that they understand the long-term effect of these political decisions. And I think that's the biggest challenge we have, and we have to make sure our voice is heard, because it's not that they're trying to do bad or evil things. It's just a lack of knowledge of the long-term effect of these decisions. And that's exactly the way I feel about interchange. And to the point, when you have that opportunity to really sit down and explain this, I don't know that I've had any politician or legislator that says, oh, now I get it, that long-term, this could be very detrimental. And then the other thing, and Richard mentioned a while ago, how many of these things really ever get to the consumer's pocket? And I think that's the big challenge of all of this. And as we know, most of the time, it never gets there. I mean, the Durbin Amendment, based upon everything I know from the past, it never got to the consumer's pocket. So I think that's the challenge of, are we really doing things that are good for the consumer? And I would challenge, no. Long range, it's going to hurt the consumer.
Mike raises a really good point. You know, a lot of this comes down to the relationships that we've built up with legislators over time. And so they really trust us to tell them the impact of the bill, the impact on their constituents. And interchange is a hard thing for some legislators to understand. And so a lot of it is an educational process of what is interchange? How is it impactful? You know, is this bill really needed? Is this going to impact? How is it going to impact prices that your constituents pay? We know how it's going to impact credit unions negatively on the business side, but are your consumers, your constituents, going to see any benefits from that? And that's really one of the strongest points we make. But the way we get the ability to make that point are relationships that credit unions like Mike's have developed over time.
Bill, I will just say this. Most lawmakers want their knee-jerk reaction is to help small business. Small business, like our credit unions, and many of them are struggling. They, through the pandemic, they've had hard times. And, you know, they don't want to adjust their prices up anymore to beat people out of the market. We understand that. We appreciate it. But legislators don't understand the benefit that these retailers have gotten from cards. 38% of the grocery stores right now are self-serve. Think about the staffing, lower staffing levels you have from that alone. Unless you live in New Jersey, you go to a gas pump, you're going to insert your credit card or walk inside and hand them your card and get your gas. And so anytime you look at these benefits, and they're made whole. When a merchant uses a card, the process, they get paid. It is a benefit, and the cost of cash is a whole lot more than people think. It's more expensive to handle cash than it is to use cards. And so these aspects of the process are not always well known to lawmakers who are legitimately trying to sympathize and help their small businesses. And they are hearing a lot from those small businesses. And I think that's why for credit unions like Mike, it's imperative to get our side of the story out again and again and again, because the merchants are plentiful. They're on board on this, and they find this is another way. And I will say one other thing, and I think this is a very unfair thing. It happens across the country, and that is surcharging. You're seeing surcharging on the part of the merchants well beyond the cost of the interchange transaction. Now, I know Visa and MasterCard have kind of put some rules in place. You can't charge more than the actual transaction. Well, I'm not sure if that's true on all the card options. They want to talk about no competition. There's plenty of competition. You now have Venmo. You have Apple Pay. You have about 14 different rails that you can go on to make payments. And they don't want to talk about that. They want to focus on predominantly Visa, MasterCard, because they're the ones that have this unique relationship with the financial issuers to provide the card. And I would say one other thing that's important here is that cart is a product. It is just like a wrench. Whether you're using that wrench to make a Maserati or you're using that wrench to tighten your kid's training wheels, it's the same wrench. Well, that's what Visa, MasterCard have done with this product. They've allowed a credit union that may be 10 million or 100 million in size to compete with the same product at the same price as a 100 billion or $1 trillion institution. And that we don't want to see go away.
And when you think about, like, at this period of time, we've been doing meetings with during the August recess with members of Congress. We'll have our Hike the Hill coming up in the fall. You know, and the message for us on this is we spend part of the meeting identifying and describing what interchange is. It's helpful if you have some kind of infographic or chart to kind of show how the whole payment system works and what the interchange piece is of that. And then our ask is after we've identified, you know, interchange and how changes can negatively impact credit unions and their members, our ask is that Congress just preserves the integrity of the current system. There's no changes needed. And that's our ask. And then we offer, you know, to credit unions like Mike or a resource to legislators so that when they're hearing from the other side, we can get them data, information, some of the stats that Mike's mentioned to refute some of the arguments from the other side. So it's an ongoing dialogue.
I would think that, like, your messaging would also resonate with small businesses and consumers. Are you involving them in the advocacy against Durbin 2.0?
Some of the small business loans, particularly, you know, we had credit unions that made a lot of PPP loans. And some of those businesses we've reached out to talk about what the impact would be upon their business if this were to come about. And, you know, what we hear from them is they don't want to see more fraud introduced into the system. They're not sure that they're going to see pricing changes like a big box retailer would. They think a small business might pay more or at least pay the same, but have a lot of more risk introduced into the system. They're very concerned about what happens if their customers go back to cash. It's riskier to use cash. People spend less money. It has a very negative impact on small business. So anything that erodes confidence in the current payment system has the potential to be very negatively impactful to small businesses is what we're finding. So we're reaching out to business partners in the small business community to try to get that message out.
Our survey research shows overwhelmingly that people are happy with the current system. And we're talking in the high 80s, 90% satisfaction. Then the three things that people care about, first and foremost, is the ease and the acceptance of the cards. They want to be able to present their card and have it accepted. Two is any liability for fraudulent activity on that card. They don't want to be liable for that. And that's something that they're very concerned about, but something they're very pleased with is the product as it currently stands. And the other aspect of it is their own personal privacy. Those are the three top things that consumers tell us that they're concerned with cards. And I think small businesses get more traffic. I mean, you think about it, and we have a small business tell us this. You walk into a restaurant with $20, $50, you're going to eat $20 or $50 worth of food, and that's it. Walk in with a credit card, you know, you may say, hey, I'll have that dessert. We've seen time and time again where people have responded. They go out to eat a couple times a week, but if they didn't have access to a credit card, it would be less. This is something that's really benefiting business, particularly small business. And I don't think that they would be happy if this were to be disrupted.
And Mike, what could happen to your card programs if this legislation does pass?
Well, as we talked about before, I do believe once something's passed, it will trickle down even to credit unions of my size. And ultimately, what will happen, I will have to go back to school districts, counties, cities that we're doing cards with and tell them I can't afford to have the revenue share I have right now. I won't be able to support it. Because if you look at the math on my P card, if that gets cut significantly, I'm giving 150 back of 2.3. So if they cut 50 basis points, I mean, is that enough for me to sustain that being able to offer these cards? So it's very frightful for me because a lot of that, and this is the tough part, this is a business model that I've chosen to give back to the community. Some of that is based upon my trust and relationship in the community. And now I'm going to have to go back and say, I can't sustain this. And that's exactly what will happen, Bill, because I won't be able to do it anymore unless I decide to make it a negative on my balance sheet. There's a great opportunity for this. people are looking for help with cards. Cards are the future for so many payments. Why would we make this harder right now? You know, and then you look at the Zelles, the Venmos. You know, Zelle had all this fraud problem because they haven't built the tools that the Visas, the MasterCards have. So when you think about protecting the consumer, and we have people that come in and say, hey, can I pay my loan with Zelle? No, you don't want to do that. You know, and that's part of it going back to, and I know Richard was talking about the math, but when you think about it for a merchant, they have no liability, and that interchange fee is on average about 1.25%. That's incredible. I mean, I wish I had outlets that I could offer something and be able to cap my liability right up front. And as you know, in this day of fraud, and fraud just is accelerating, the ability for credits to do the right thing for their members, and that's a great story here too. A lot of times, we make the member whole when we don't have to. And interchange income helps us to be able to do that. When you get into it, it's just the philosophy of credit unions giving back. This has the potential to change the way we do things on so many different levels. Once it starts, does it trickle into other areas of income that we've historically been able to share? And as you know, if you look at the balance sheet of a credit union, we don't make a lot of money anywhere. We make a little bit here and there and there. And collectively, it enables us to do what we do in the communities. But all of these are very important to the philosophical way that we give back. And every credit union gives back in different ways. So it really attacks our whole model of being a not-for-profit financial institution. That's the real fear I have of this long range.
Wow, that's well put, Mike. Any other issues you'd like to address? Any other angles of this that you think we should look into more?
You know, we have had several bills at the state level to exclude the tax calculation from interchange. Again, you kind of wonder where they come up with this, but it's something that would totally change the system. It's something that is going to cause disruption, not just for individuals within the financial services sector, but the merchant sector, because all their terminals, everything's going to change. And we have another study coming out on this shortly from Cornerstone Advisors, kind of delving into some of the problems on the processing side. And most of the processors I've talked to says that this is, if not an impossibility, a very impractical way to do it. So let's stay tuned and see what we're going to get. But we know we saw several bills last year, and we will probably see several more. Again, it kind of gets back to that whole mantra that merchants aren't willing to pay for the cost of doing business.
And Bill, something I might share that is very important. So here in Illinois, we started a program called Bank on Illinois. Bank on is a national program that basically makes sure that a lot of times it touches people that are cash users. And the reason why they're cash users, a lot of times they come from other countries where their financial system, for lack of a better word, is corrupt. So they come to the United States and they have a distrust for banking and everything. Now, we talked about this earlier. Cash is not a good thing in the system. I mean, the government, but it's just anything things are done with cash, they're not tracked. You think about the Patriot Act, there's just so many downsides. So when you think about cards, what we're trying to do here in Illinois is mainly stream these people. So we have a checking account that we have to have certified to be part of Bank on Illinois that no way, no shape, no form can have any fees. Now, long range, I don't know that that's the best checking account, because if you mess up and pay a payment late, it's great that your institution covers that. But my point is, as they try to restrict things, it's going to be harder for organizations like mine and others in the state that want to help people in their transition, their financial path, and cards is a part of this. Because I would challenge right now today, the best way to pay every bill is a credit card. You have the best protection in the event of fraud. You can dispute anything on the card if you don't agree with it. And if you're smart, you can use that card and get incredible benefits with trips, all these incentive programs. So when you think about it in total, cards is a wonderful tool. Now, when you think about that, who pays for that incentive program that that card gives you? Me. Other banks, other credit unions. So we have created something, an incredible useful tool. So when you think about a loyalty card, those people typically never hold a balance. I don't. I'm a loyalty card junkie. If they take interchange or reduce it, can I be as generous? Can Chase be as generous with a Southwest card, whatever card, than they are right now? And you don't put that number in there. What is the benefit to the consumer with loyalty cards? It's big. And it's smart. And it's the best way to pay your bills. It's the safest way. And indirectly, if you're smart and you're good with money, you're getting paid to use the card. And the only way those organizations support those programs is interchange, period. Now, some of them have annual fees.
Let me get a quick, just a reaffirmation of what you just said. 75% of those consumers that have cards have rewards attached to them for loyalty cards. Out of that, 42% say that they spend more money with the rewards card, at least sometimes, than they would otherwise. So again, a benefit to the merchants in the sense it is a marketing push for them. They're spending more money at a merchant because they have that loyalty card. And they say, you know what, I'll spend an extra $50 because I get the points or I get the cash back, whatever it is. So, you know, it's a huge boon for the merchants.
And if you think about it, so a great example of that, I tithe at my church with my loyalty card. And my church loves it. And here's the reason why. We have a reoccurring setup. They automatically get it every month. And they don't have a bunch of volunteers in a back room having to count the money every Sunday. Think about that. It brings efficiency. Even though they have to pay a little fee, it is a much better model for them than the labor-intensive model they're used to. And you know, we don't even think about that. A lot of churches and foundations and other organizations in the nation, that is their preferred method to be paid now. It's done online. It's easy. It's all done with credit cards. So once again, how does that change the model for a church? Because they have to pay a fee for that. Does that increase that fee for that not-for-profit? There's so many ways this is connected in the financial realm. It's not just credit unions. There's so many people going to be affected if this goes into law. So when we do these cards in the community, the other side benefit that is massive is the marketing effort. So a local bank, typically a larger institution, is not going to issue a card for a school district that our goal is to have 1,000 cards in 3 years. But what happens with that card, it has the school districts and even more important, the foundation's logo on it. So a lot of these local educational foundations, one of their biggest challenges, nobody knows about them. So just issuing these cards in the community, and I will tell you, I personally have, my wife worked in a school district. It's really fun, and their logo is the bulldog. Every time I bring that bulldog card out in the community, people ask this. It's really interesting. They say, where'd you get that? Because they connect with that local school district. And then something I haven't shared, which is huge, what we call our cards through the school districts is a card with purpose. You're not just using a card for your own personal use. You're actually using a card that helps to build your community. Isn't that cool? And that is our logo, Building Stronger Communities Together. And we live that every day. But cards is a piece of how we do that. And, you know, one of the things I think every credit union, every organization struggles with this, philosophy is really easy to talk about. But it's a different thing to do it. And cards are a tangible way every day I get to show the community my philosophy in action. And that's cool. And I would hate to lose that because it has become such a big part of who we are in the community.
We have a system that works. It works for the benefit of the consumer. It works for the benefit of the merchants. And we're trying to fix something that's not broken. And all because somebody thinks they're going to gain the system for it, and that's just not right. And when you look at the consumers, you look at the impact, it's not a good idea. We've seen it in action before. Let's not double down on a bad idea.
Thanks for listening to the CUNA News Podcast. Subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube.